I'm Brittany French.
Hey, I'm Rob McDonald.
And this is the Great Plains Outdoors Podcast.
We're going to talk about everything from fishing and hunting to hiking, paddling, and adventures on the Great Plains. We'll cover it all here.
So join us each episode and hear what's going on in the great outdoors on the Great Plains. Welcome to the Great Plains Outdoors Podcast. The time has come to talk all things hunting. I know I'm very excited about this season, and I think that there's just something really special when September 1st rolls around. The weather cools off, hunting seasons across the Great Plains start to open, and you start hearing about all these memories created by families, by individuals outdoors, and I just think that is so special, and I love to hear it. Rob, I know you guys have had a busy summer, one thing after another, so I'm sure you're ready for a change in pace with hunting season.
Yeah, hey, Brittany, I am always ready for hunting season. You know, some things coincide with that, like you said, cooler weather, football, bonfires, you know, all that good stuff. But tell you the truth, I feel like maybe we're even past full swing. Like, it happens so fast. I know in Kansas, just one of the states on the Great Plains, that our early prairie chicken season has been open for a little bit. The dove migration is going on. That season's open. The rifle youth season that we had for, you know, any deer, that's come and gone already. So there's a whole season past us. Teal season, the muzzleloader deer season has been open and closed. Antelope season's going on right now. The duck seasons are coming up, upland hunting, archery season for deer is open, rifle season for deer is coming up. You've got the elk seasons that happen in Kansas, like, and that's not to, you know, all the other guys are making trips up to the plains of Montana and the Dakotas and chasing those upland birds already. So, man, when it turns on, it's like drinking out of a fire hose, I think. So,
it is a full press.
Yeah. There is a lot of opportunity for hunters on the Great Plains right now. That is for sure.
Yeah. I saw this thing the other day. It said, the seasons are short, so take advantage of them, right? Like that, that one weekend you get skunked and you think like, oh, I'm not going to go out the next weekend. Changing your perspective on that and how fast the season goes will certainly re-encourage you to get outdoors because it doesn't wait on anybody.
That's right.
Yeah. I love it. Well, I'm excited because we have a great guest on our podcast today who is really great about capitalizing on all things hunting in this space. And I'm looking forward to introducing you. Shane Onick is our guest today. And Shane is the owner and operator of CNS Whitetails, located outside of El Dorado, Kansas. CNS is a family business that started in 2006 with Shane's dad, Chad, and Stacy Weiss. Since the beginning, Shane has been extremely involved in the operations, and in 2020, Shane and his wife, Tori, took over the operations formally. As outfitters, CNS Whitetails currently leases over 32,000 acres of prime hunting land in the Flint Hills of Kansas, with the goal of providing their clients with the opportunity for a giant Kansas whitetail buck. And y'all, if you go check out their Facebook page, they knocked down a few giant whitetail bucks, that's for sure. CNS also runs turkey, waterfowl, and predator hunts. Shane and his team put a great effort into concentrating on conservation through wildlife and land management, and they firmly believe in passing it on to the next generation and have been working with outdoor mentors for many, many years. I can't even recall the date as early as we got started working with Chad, Shane's dad, but it's been a very long time, and we're very thankful for that. Outside of running the business, Shane is a dad to a one-year-old boy named Cole William and has been married to his wife, Tori, for 4 years. He enjoys about anything outdoors, traveling, spending time with family, sports, and Chiefs football. I think we can all get on board with that one. Go Chiefs. Shane, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for being here with us.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me.
Well, let's jump in. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Shane. I know you from some Western Kansas connections, but why don't you give a little snapshot of who you are, how you're brought up in the outdoors? What do you love?
So I grew up being my dad's bird dog or running with his bird dogs when we were still too young to carry the shotgun ourselves. And actually, the state of Kansas changed it when I turned 12 was the first year they opened it up to any ages as long as you had your hunter safety card or were with a with somebody with one. So I had to wait until I was 12 to start hunting the turkeys and the deer. And now the kids get to start, you know, whenever their parents or guardians think they're ready. So growing up, I have a twin brother, and we would follow bird dogs through the brush and go flush up quail for my dad, and just got into it. Turkey hunting was a big thing that we did growing up with him, and deer hunting, and just a lot of upland, and then just over the years slowly expanded. And now I feel like I've got my toes dipped into about every option that Kansas has to offer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you certainly have that traditional hunting heritage lineage in your family, right? You guys wanted to go, and you guys were, you know, privileged enough to have that opportunity to get out there. And I just love that opportunity your parents created for you and your family, because it's now going to be generational, not just you, right? But your kiddo is going to be a hunter, and future kiddos will be hunters as well.
That's the goal, and that's what we're hoping for. Like we said, I've got a 1-year-old son named Cole William, and hopefully all this goes to him one day. And as he's growing up, we've got the land in place now that he should have all the opportunities in the world to get out and enjoy God's creation. And
yeah, that's what it's all about. Amen to that. I love that. Let's talk about CNS Whitetails. How did that get started? Can you elaborate on that a little bit for us?
Well, it started, I think it was back in 2005, which I was still in high school. My dad was out elk hunting in Colorado with his good friend, Stacy Weiss, and Stacy's from Kentucky, and mentioned having a few friends that would like to come out and try chasing these big deer around in Kansas. And so the first year or two, they picked up a couple of properties and started working with some really great landowners and ranchers and farmers around the area, and kind of just slowly took off. And now we are running over 32,000 acres. I believe we've probably got the best farmers and ranchers in a long area all signed up. We lease their properties, we bring folks in, and truly get to show them what it's like hunting some of the best properties in this part of Kansas.
I appreciate, Shane, how you explain how the lifestyle is in your blood, and how that developed into obviously your dad was sharing his passion for hunting out in the mountains chasing some elk, and probably met another guy that had the same passion from Kentucky you mentioned. And to see that develop into the outfitting business, I'm just curious, you know, how does that work? Just the nuts and bolts of it, right? I mean, you decide, hey, we're just going to lease some property and start selling some hunts. I know it's a lot, it takes a lot more than that, right? There's a lot of footwork and legal work and planning. So what does that process look like?
So all of our properties, we've got a liability insurance on. So when our clients come in, you know, they sign the liability waiver before stepping foot on the properties. The most of our ranches, we have multi-year contracts with them, and they know that we're not going in and using or abusing the properties. We're not leaving ruts, we're not leaving tracks, we're not leaving trash anywhere, and never have. And now we've gotten to the point where the last 3 years since my wife and I have taken over most of the new properties that we picked up, it's landowners talking to other landowners and getting good referrals about us. And they'll actually call us now and say, you know, we talked to so-and-so, and they kind of really enjoy what you guys have going on, and would you be interested in our property? And it's just one of those things. We'll go check it out, you know, set up a camera, do some scouting, do a walkthrough, and truly trying to pick up the best properties around. And I think we've got a great collection of them.
That's, I've always kind of wondered how that worked, you know, not ever being exposed to that outfitting business much. Yeah. So as you developed, you know, I think about 2005 doesn't seem like that long ago, but I mean, that was almost 20 years ago, right?
Wild.
So maybe I'm just showing my age, but I understand that you guys have become, you know, if not the premier, one of the premier outfitters for what you do in the region. So I'm curious, what's that like, you know, to kind of, I mean, you're kind of held to a higher standard, right?
Yeah. And it's just, you know, it's a lot of work, a lot of maintaining, and trying to run as few clients on as much land as we can, just to let the deer age structure get to where we want it to be. And obviously most of these properties we've been hunting or managing for 15 plus years, and we've got some new ones we've picked up over the time. And it's just my goal is I want to get as much land, run as few hunters, and just let that age structure get to where we need it. And this September, the first week of black powder season, the quality of deer we're killing is almost unbelievable. And I just feel like we're very quickly moving in the right direction and very excited to see some of the bucks that we put down this fall.
What do you see as more popular from a client, you know, booking standpoint, Shane? Do you see folks coming in saying like, yeah, I want a black powder, you know, rifle hunt. Do I want a bull hunt? I want to wait till that Kansas, you know, rifle season. What does that look like for you? Is it widespread?
Yeah, it's we've got guys that really enjoy coming out for the September hunt, which we typically only hunt in the evenings. Most years it's 90 degrees and
hot.
Pretty brutal conditions to be out trying to enjoy a deer hunt. But with that being said, the deer have been coming out to the same soybeans or the same alfalfa field all summer, and it makes them where they're pretty patternable and where we run a pretty high opportunity rate. But I would say most people want to come out and experience the Kansas rut, and they want to be sitting in a tree stand and see what it's like when a you know when the draw that they're sitting in just comes to life with a hot doe coming through, and no telling how many bucks will be on that doe out here. And just I think that's probably the coolest thing to experience is coming out for the rut.
Yeah, it's so fun to, and I recently was able to connect with some of your clients when we did some new segments out there with you guys, but it's fun to see some of these out-of-staters just get a little buck wild, as I like to say. They do get googly-eyed about, you know, the opportunities in Kansas because they are so unique. We do have large deer and many deer compared to a lot of other states. That's just the reality.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's everybody that comes out, you know, they're coming out. It's most of their trip of the year, trip of a lifetime. And they're coming out with the goal of harvesting their biggest whitetail they've ever killed. And it's a lot of high expectations. And that's why we do what we do. And we've got the properties, we've got the ranches and farms set up now. And I just feel like we are skyrocketing in the right direction. Our opportunity rates, our success rates, I think are all well above average when compared to any other outfitters in the Midwest. And we're just hoping to keep it rolling and put clients on the biggest bucks of their lives, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. How many clients are you guys booking, Shane?
So this year for buck hunts, we've got about 60 guys coming in counting all seasons. And we kind of bottleneck it down into 7 weeks of running clients over a 3-month season with just the goal of not having the highest pressure on our land. And we want the neighbors to moving on to us. We've got a lot of the feed. We've got a lot of the bedding, a lot of the cover. And we try to really stick to low pressure. And when we're going in and hunting places, you know, we're hunting them smart. During archery season, we're sitting all day. If the wind switches at lunchtime, we'll go and get everybody out of their stand and get them adjusted to a different tree stand where the wind's in their face. And, you know, we're not blowing out spots. And I think that goes a long way in holding big deer on our property and keeping them on our property.
Yeah, that's wise.
So Shane, a topic, I guess it maybe, I don't want, without getting too political, let's just talk a little bit about just the nature of your business. I could see where it would be a little bit tricky, right? So you are pursuing a public resource that belongs to every resident of the state of Kansas, right? Kansas residents own all of the deer. And you have the private land that public resource is on. You're managing the public resource, but, you know, technically those deer belong to anybody that pays taxes, has a residency in the state of Kansas, not somebody from out of state, right? They're not their deer. So how do you balance that? Like, no doubt, I think about, you know, when you say, hey, we've got 32,000 acres of property leased, somebody was probably hunting that property before you guys leased it, right? I mean, there's a long tradition of people hunting in Kansas, hunting deer, whatever. So I'm just curious, you know, you still live in the area, your kids go to school, you know, you go to the grocery store. So how do you balance that where the resource that you're selling is access to a public commodity, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah. And it's definitely tough. You know, we're trying to walk a line of, you know, keeping everybody happy. And it's one of those things over time, you know, over the last 20 years, 30 years, generational farmers, generational ranchers that have been doing strictly that and being able to make a living to support their families now our part of Kansas is in the worst drought the last 2 years that we've been in almost since the Great Depression. And it's just getting tougher. Farmers are having a harder time making their living off of farming, off of ranching, with the grass being depleted, with hauling. You know, I know several ranchers that are hauling ungodly amounts of waters just to try to keep their cattle in good shape this summer. And it's something that if, you know, the whitetail deer, the turkeys, whatever on their property that live on their property all year, you know, if they can make income off of that also, then I'm here to support those local farmers and ranchers and all about adding to their supplemental income. And, you know, if bringing in non-residents to enjoy our outdoors is the best way to do that, then that's what we're doing, which we welcome. You know, we'll sell hunts to locals, to non-residents, you know, whoever wants to come out. I'm paying high dollars to lease this land, and so I charge high dollars for people to come and hunt it. But everybody I have coming in, you know, they've got a guide walking them into their stand. It's not one of those deals where we cut them loose and say, this is your ranch for the week. They've got me, my father, or one of our guides that work pretty much year round for us, taking them in. And, you know, we're not beating up the properties. We are probably killing less deer on all of our properties than any of the other neighboring properties around. And also, with all that being said, it's a, you know, part of the reason we bring so many kids out to hunt is to share that opportunity with some kids that may not ever have the opportunity to hunt some of the primetime ranches or farms in the area. You know, we bring out 15 to 20 kids every fall. And last year, I think we had 17 kids out and 15 of them brought deer home. So we're trying to put them in great spots where they can truly enjoy a magical evening in the woods and try to set that foundation for those kids loving the outdoors.
It's such a, like, tightrope kind of line to walk, right? Because you do want to be so respectful of, you know, public land access, public deer, you know, who owns the rights to what, how are outfitters across the country reshaping, right, the future of hunting and fishing, the current state of hunting and fishing. But I think you guys, Shana, you do such a great job at that. And to echo what you just mentioned, last year y'all hosted what, 17, is that what you said, kids for us? Yep. On the pre-rut antlerless season, which is a really cool opportunity in Kansas specifically. Not sure about across the Great Plains if these opportunities also exist. I imagine something similar though. But there's a two-day window in time where kids, adults, really anyone can get out and hunt anything without antlers. It's a legal opportunity to shoot that deer. What I love about working with you all, Shane, is 20 kids from, really, quite frankly, El Dorado is a rural town, but it's a town right outside of a big urban area. And so a lot of these kids are definitely green to the sport of hunting, very new to it, at least if they have done anything. So they're getting to experience a whole new walk of life with you all. They don't know what it's like to manage acreage. They don't know what it looks like to hang tree stands, to make sure blinds are up, to put in food plots, to do the scouting. I mean, all of those things that you guys put into place, through your business, you know, kids are getting the opportunity to reap the benefits of that. So thank you for that. And thanks for trying to find that balance too, for what you do as a business, but also what you do for the rest of us.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something, you know, we're going to keep working towards, and it's always a fine line. And there's plenty of locals, I promise you, that are strongly opposed to outfitters and outfitting, but you know, who are they to go to the landowners and tell them they shouldn't be making, you know, another form of income if they can lease out their hunting property to people that are going to respect it, people that are going to take care of it? I mean, if they can't, you know, the farmers and ranchers are just having a tougher and tougher time, it seems, and especially with this drought not helping. You know, I've got no problem going and writing them a check and bringing in folks and, you know, I'm just helping them with their supplemental income.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll be curious to see what that looks like in the long game too, right? Like, I mean, what if we do have a change in weather? What if we do have, you know, change in drought, whatever that looks like? I wonder how that plays out for you all. And just also just, you never know, right? Like, what's getting put into public land hunting, what access is becoming available, what's going away. That'll be very fun to follow you guys throughout the years to come and how that looks.
Yeah, and there's, you know, already a lot of changes coming down. The state's talking about banning the supplemental feeding. Mm-hmm. I think they've already closed down non-resident access to public land for waterfowl from Wednesdays through Saturdays and some other stuff like that. And there's just a lot of things changing, and I'm very curious to see where some of these things are going to go and which direction they're going to take off to.
Yeah, it could be a moving target for sure. So I'm curious, I'd like to touch back on, so my family owns and operates cow-calf ranch in the Flint Hills as well. And so I know the area real well. I know the dynamics of the business that you're talking about, the ag producers. And I just think about like our neighboring ranches and how one manager's opinion or their process, what they put together on their ranch may be different than somebody else's process, even to accomplish the same goal. So when I start thinking about, you mentioned over 32,000 acres of private lands to manage. So that's a number of different ranch managers and landowners and families that maybe have different goals for their property. That's got to be like a big bowl of spaghetti. How do you guys work that out as far as, you know, who's got what practices and what they're comfortable with, and whether that's, you know, fences and gates and waterways and stands, or there's probably a lot of things that I don't even think about that you deal with on a daily basis.
Yeah. And that's, like you said, almost every property I lease is on a working cattle ranch, or it's on a working farm where people are doing that to make their living. And so with us coming in and getting the hunting rights off of those properties, it's, you know, we never tell them anything what to do with the cattle, anything what to do with the farming. You know, some of them we've been working with a long time, and they will ask, you know, what could help us or what would hurt us, and they'll work with us on stuff. But we kind of stay out of the way of the cattle operation, out of the way of the farming operation. We don't go driving across ag fields ever. You know, if it's raining and muddy, we make everybody walk in from the gates. And that's just something that's help blossom our relationship with landowners, is taking care of their properties. And several of the ranches that we've gotten on in the last few years are because they were tired of whoever was hunting that property before doing the exact things we're talking about, leaving trash, leaving ruts going in and out of, you know, to where they're hunting out on the property. And it's things that the people that own those properties don't enjoy, going across and seeing ruts going across their hay field, or, you know, I mean, we've seen people drive across standing corn crops, you know, driving across standing soybeans to go recover their deer. And that's not something you're going to keep a good relationship with your landowner for very long doing those things. And we are very diligent about keeping the best relationships we can with them and taking care of their property, you know, better than we would our own, or, you know, as good.
Mm-hmm, sure. So as we're looking at, you know, we decided, Brittany and I talked about having you on kind of, we knew you were going to be getting busy, and we want to be respectful of your time, but we hope listeners, you know, are out there, whether they're going to be pursuing whitetail deer, mule deer, whatever. You know, I'm getting ready to head to Wyoming on elk hunt here in a week.
You rub it in our faces, Rob. Yeah.
I just had to throw that in there, but
I'm just going to casually put that out there.
Yeah. But as people are getting ready for their deer season, whether they're going to be, you know, archery hunting, like when muzzleloader is closing out or is closed out in Kansas, but, you know, some other states have different season dates. And what are a couple tips? I mean, you've been in this a while between your own hunting career and then the outfitting. What are some things that maybe somebody wouldn't think, you know, like you mentioned, keep the wind in your face. Hopefully most deer hunters, if you've done it very long, you're going to understand the wind direction, right? But what are a few things that maybe are outside the box or something we hadn't thought about that would help you fill that deer tag? Whether you're a DIY and you're driving out and you're just going to hit public land, or you went with an outfitter, whatever it is, you have a couple nuggets of wisdom for us.
Yeah, I think, you know, whether you're hunting private land, public land, if you're sharing a farm with somebody, whatever the case is, trying to figure out where those deer are getting pressured from and hunting around that, I think, is one of our biggest keys to success. And also, when the rut starts in Kansas, as you guys know living here, it's a pretty magical time. And we get a lot of folks that want to sit down on the river bottom and look at the crop fields with 20 or 30 or 40 deer coming out on them. And typically during November and even the rifle season in Kansas, the first 2 weeks of December, we have a lot of our best success and best luck on the little drainages coming out of the creek bottoms and going out into the Flint Hills or going out into the pastures and finding where those mature bucks can go to be safe has really done a lot for our opportunity rates. But that's, I would say, anyone coming to Kansas, find, you know, if you're hunting a big place with river bottom or core land on the edge of the lakes where it's public, find those ditches that are going out into the pastures or out into the to the Flint Hills if you're in the right part of the state for that, and sit up and wait. And if we make all, pretty much all of our clients sit all day, and that's so when everybody else gets done hunting on the neighboring properties or on the public land, when they're walking out at 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock or whatever time they're hunting, till if you're sitting in your tree stand, everybody else doing anything, all they're doing is getting deer moving. And hopefully by that time in the morning, you know, if the wind's in your face, you're part of the woods, and none of the animals around are alerted. And we kill a lot of deer and get a lot of opportunities just hunting the pressure around us.
That's one to put in your pipe and smoke for a long time.
Yeah, there's a lot of, it just makes you wonder how many people get out of their tree stands and then 30 minutes after they're gone, what walks in front of them, right?
Yeah. And just having no idea, you know?
Yeah. There's a lot to be said about that. What, Shane, there's some things that, I want to talk about. I know Rob mentioned, like, hey, if you are a deer hunter, what do you, you know, what's some tips and tricks? How do you find it to be most successful serving kids? Like, your dad did this for a long time for Outdoor Mentors, rounding up kids, hosting kids on deer hunts, and you did a heck of a job last year. Everything from getting kids checked in with name tags to sighting in some guns to feeding them to getting them into the blinds and even going over things like, hey, y'all, like, I know you could probably carry your gun out to the blind on your strap on your shoulder, but we're going to keep that gun in the case until we get to the blind, because we don't need to miss a shot because we accidentally bumped into a tree, right? And bumped our scope. What are some tips if you're taking out some first timers, whether they be kids or even young adults, even adults, right? Like, what are some, like, fast tips you could give them for success and having fun?
I would say safety is always the number one concern. Yeah. And secondly is, like, in October when we're doing this youth hunt, the mosquitoes, the chiggers, the ticks are still bad. And so getting everybody permethrined up on their outside layer, getting their socks sprayed down with off, and just keeping them comfortable. You know, if you're out there and you're getting chewed on, you got 30 ticks crawling up your leg, it can ruin someone's experience pretty quickly. And so when we bring, when we bring these kids in for the youth hunt this year, we've had a few people step up and donate some things to help us get for the kids. So we've got everybody a can of bug spray to put in their pack. We got this year, we got packs donated that we can fill up with stuff. But just whether it's a kid or whether it's, you know, an older person or someone in my age range, you know, you got to be comfortable out there. You got to be dressed for it. If it's cold, you got to have the proper gear to stay warm. If it's warm, you got to have the, you know, cold water with you, or, you know, whatever you need, but just safety and staying comfortable, and obviously hunting places where there's a lot of deer around help out a bunch with that too.
Yeah. Yeah. I got to ask, what's your take on this? And this is probably a slippery slope for you to answer, like, 100% truthfully, right? Like, do you prefer working with folks from out of state, or do you prefer working with, you know, local Kansas people?
Most of my clientele are non-residents coming from out of state. And that's simply I believe for the fact that most of the locals that would, or even if it's locals that go on outfitted hunts in Colorado or Wyoming for mule deer, for elk or whatnot, the people that have the extra money to spend on hunting typically have their own leases or their own property and stuff like that. And so it hasn't worked out for me to get very many locals to come in and pay for the hunts, which, you know, I'm not biased. Whoever wants to pay me to access my land, you know, we do custom packages, you know, I'll work out deals with people if they can make it on free weekends instead of a Monday through Friday, you know, I'll do whatever we can to get them out here and in the woods.
Yeah. Yeah, I wondered if that was the case. Also, like, let's face it, we're in a strange economy right now too, right? So if people have disposable income, they're probably holding on to it a little tighter than normal. So that doesn't surprise me that you're kind of looking at a unique demographic there. I love when I share some of these things with kids, you know, what's an outfitter, right? That's such a strange word for them. Like, they have no idea. A land manager, all that stuff. It's such a opportunity to teach these kids about what are some career paths you can choose to go down. What are some ways, if you can't find public access, right? Or maybe you're just not having luck with public access, where are some other points you can find access and opportunity in the outdoors? I think there's a big barrier in knowledge and education there with outfitters. And a lot of it's because of, you know, media around that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's like you said, it's kind of a slippery slope. And, you know, anybody that wants to get a hunt from us, you know, we're not biased. We'll sell hunts to whoever wants to make it out. And as far as getting the kids and stuff outdoors, you know, this year we got 20 children coming out for outdoor mentors, and you know, it's probably 20 kids that wouldn't have the opportunity otherwise. And so when they come out this year, we've got a bunch of sponsors lined up, and we're getting them all a pair of Vortex Optics Elites, donating a bow that we're going to try to figure out a way to raffle off and get in some lucky kids' hands. And we just want to provide as many opportunities as we can to these local kids, just to get the, you know, get the fire started in their soul for hunting at a young age. And, you know, stuff we've worked with kids that we've had out in the past that are too old now to do the youth hunt, you know, stay in touch, and they'll come out in the January antlerless season, you know, we'll do whatever we can to keep providing them that opportunity.
So Shane, you're mentioning, you know, we've got this, this early antlerless season, and we've got the late antlerless season. So you have some opportunities there to get some folks out, like, you know, partnering with outdoor mentors or maybe a veterans organization, something like that. I know we talked early in the introduction that you guys maybe do some waterfowl, some turkeys in the spring, predator hunting. I'm curious, just touch on a few other aspects of your business maybe besides strictly whitetail hunting.
So the last couple of years, I've started taking a few groups of waterfowl clients in. It's, my dad was never really a waterfowl hunter growing up. And so when I was in high school, I started kind of going with buddies and getting into it. And it's one of those things. I think the waterfowl hunting in central Kansas is absolutely blown up. And now it's gotten to the point where every field, every pond around is getting leased up. People are getting permission. And so places around where I grew up, you know, we had several different farms where me and a group of buddies have been hunting since high school. And it's kind of one of those deals. We stay in touch, and, you know, you guys are hunting it Saturday, let it set a week, we'll go hunt it the next weekend, and just kind of rotate. And now all those fields are being leased up, and just trying to keep it where I've got places to waterfowl hunt and take my clients. We've started leasing stuff for just to shoot ducks and geese off. And I don't run waterfowl hunters every day after deer season or every day of the fall and winter. I think this year I've got 6 groups booked up, which are all going to be 3 morning hunts. And so I don't do a lot of it, but that's one of those deals. I like, you know, I'm going to want to take my son here in a few years when he's old enough. And right now that's the way for me to make sure I've got places to take him.
Gotcha. What about predator hunts? That's something you guys have like recently gotten into as well too. I know you've always done it, but I've seen more and more advertising from you guys on that, like through social media, things like that.
With Kansas opening the thermal season, I think 2 years ago was the first year. Yeah, it's just something we've never done, you know, never could do in Kansas. And those thermals make it a heck of a lot of fun. And I would say 99.99% of farmers or ranchers in Kansas are all for all the coyotes, you know, being eliminated, or as many as can be. And, you know, we've got places, I've got ranchers, when they start having calves in the spring, you know, they're calling, asking if we can come over and help out with coyote problems. And plus, having 32,000 acres that I'm trying to manage for trophy whitetails is, you know, that's enough to keep me busy the entire all fall and winter. But that's just a lot of fun. That thermal season is a complete game changer, as far as, you know, we can go out in the night and see 15 or 20 or 25 coyotes, whereas 5 years ago you could go out in the daytime, make great sits, keep the wind right, and a great day, you know, might be seeing 6 or 8 or 10 coyotes would be a really, really great day, and killing a few would be the cherry on top. Now we can go out with these stalls, make the same stands and see triple the coyotes. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I always laugh when we get a lot of parents who ask us, you guys do thermal hunts? I'm like, are you asking for your kid or for yourself? And it's just because there's so much curiosity around that. I mean, it is such a unique experience and opportunity. I have yet to be on a thermal hunt, but I can imagine it just brings a completely different feel and perspective to hunting than you have from traditional blind sitting and for deer hunting or upland hunting. It's just night and day difference.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it keeps you busy. We got the nice rifles on tripods. And so when we're out there, you're literally standing like that, just scanning back and forth, you know, the whole 20 or 25 minutes you're on a stand. And I've come to really enjoy it, but it's definitely a lot more, can provide a lot more opportunity opportunities than just daylight hunting. And it's, you know, the coyotes seem to be a lot more brave at nighttime as far as coming across open prairies or open fields, come running into a call. And it's definitely a lot of fun.
Yeah. I love that. Shane, there's a story I was thinking on before we got started on this podcast, and I'm excited to kind of share it because I don't know if I've told you this or not. But when I first got started with Outdoor Mentors, and I'm not trying to steal the thunder here for Outdoor Mentors publicity, but I just think it's a rich story. And I'm curious if you have a similar story, because I know Rob's got a Rolodex full of them. But we, when I first started with Outdoor Mentors as a volunteer in 2015, the first deer hunt I helped with was actually out on your dad's hunt. And it was, I think, the September youth season. So significantly hotter than the October pre-rut season. Like, I think it was like 100 plus degrees. We're in this very hot black metal box blind. And this sweet girl, Christiane is her name. I still remember her very well. I probably can find the pictures for you guys. We are just sweating up a storm in this blind. It's pretty miserable. But she is a typical inner city kid, never had the opportunity, had just passed hunter ed, but was really excited to learn. But before we even got into that blind, this paints a perspective to Shane, your outfitting business and the lineage it has, right? Bill Ferris, I don't know if you know that name. So Bill was one of the landowners or ranchers, maybe, perhaps, I was involved in this, but we're all sitting around. We just got done sighting in guns, and all of a sudden I see Bill wad up a piece of paper and just kind of drop it on the ground. It's like, well, that's weird. I didn't think anything of it. I just kind of watched it play out, and he just kind of stood there, just looking. Nobody picked up that piece of paper. And later we go in, and we're talking about gun safety, getting ready to go out to the blinds, and, you know, he goes, hey, I have a bone to pick with all of you and all of us in the room, kids, mentors, everybody, right? Do you see this piece of paper? And he holds it up and he goes, this was sitting on the ground. Like, how many of you saw it? And, you know, very shamefully, I said, I saw it. Like, I just didn't know what was going on. And he goes, you know what? This isn't your land, but it's also God's land, and we have to respect it and take care of it. So whether you dropped it, you saw someone dropped it, or you see it out of the corner of your eye and you don't even know what it is, you pick it up. And I appreciated that so, so much. You know, it's something we were always taught growing up. Leave it better than you found it, right? Clean up your room. Don't go to your friend's house and make a mess. But for Bill to sit there and demonstrate that message the way he did, it was just so profound. I mean, it's grilled in my memory. Like, I can see the picture of the room in my head very clearly. We went on to talk about gun safety, and this was, again, my first deer hunt I helped mentor with Outdoor Mentors. And he holds up this firearm and he goes, see this barrel? And we're all like, yes, Bill, at the end of this barrel is death. I was like, holy moly, what are we doing here? But it was just like, man, he's so right. Like, we are going to really teach the weight and responsibility of hunting right now in this moment. We're going to capitalize on the opportunity we have. And, you know, going out to that blind, you know, every kid marching out to that blind, even mentors like myself, we perked up a little bit. We were looking for trash. Yep. We were making sure that gun was pointed in the right direction, that everybody was being safe, and that when that opportunity came to harvest that deer, it was just that much sweeter. So I love those memories, because I know that's just one take that I've had from the multiple times I've hunted with you guys, and taking kids. And gosh, that was back in 2015. So, I mean, imagine all the years in between that and before that, that this has gone on. So I'd have to say that's one of my favorite CNS whitetail memories with your dad and some of those landowners out there. It's pretty sweet.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, you know, the lesson he's teaching there is something that should be in every youth hunter, every adult hunter, regardless of if you're hunting private, public. You know, if you're going out and enjoying God's creation, you should always leave it better than you found it. You should never walk by trash without picking it up and putting it in your pocket and taking it out with you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I jokingly still use some of those one-liners with some of our kids. I often get the, Miss Brittany, that seems really intense for your personality. I'm like, yeah, I know, but it works.
It sits out in stone in their heads forever, you know?
Yeah.
That's good stuff. Well, hey, Shane, if you're up for it, we traditionally do lightning round where we've got eight questions that are sort of, they're pretty lighthearted, this or that, maybe your favorite something. We fire them off and you can really answer however there's no right answer. And if you want to expand on it a little bit, you can, or if it's just a quick, simple yes, no, left, right, up, down, that's fine too. So if you're good with it, I think we'll kick off the lightning round.
Yes, sir. I'm ready.
All right. Okay.
No
so
pressure.
Yeah, no pressure. Let's look at these questions. I'm thinking about how I put them together. Let's look at these questions as your personal, as a hunter, not as an outfitter, but as you, Shane, the deer hunter, what's your preference? So number one, would you prefer to pursue whitetails in Kansas with archery, center fire rifle, or a muzzleloader? What's your favorite?
Definitely archery.
Okay. Number two, you're out, you get to choose, and you're going to have an encounter either way. So how would you prefer to have that encounter? Was it a peak rut chase phase? You know, you got those, the doe comes by your stand and you're looking because there could be 2, 3, 4 bucks coming after. Or is it a post rut food and groceries? You know, those bucks are going to get those calories and they're on their feet. Which one do you prefer?
I like feeling like I'm interacting with them. And so I like being in the middle of the rut and just blind calling. Rather be grunting or doing a snort wheeze or smacking a pair of antlers together as hard as I can and watching them get bristled up and come slipping in.
Okay. Yeah, I can respect that for sure. So number three, for anybody that's not familiar, the Kansas rifle season generally lands about the first week of December. And that time of year, depending on how Mother Nature's feeling, it could be like 60 degrees in sunshine, or it could be like 10 degree wind chill with blowing snow and you're freezing your butt off. Which one of those do you prefer if you're hunting the rifle season? Cold and snow and wind, or mild and sunny?
The colder the better. Makes them, you know, make the deer come to the food sources. A lot of times here, you know, you're either getting that second rut or the tail end of the first rut, and we still, you know, are seeing bucks cruising. But if it's cold, you know, they're going to have to come out to the food source in the evenings, and it can make it really eventful hunts.
Okay. All right. So that leads me to question number four. You're talking about food sources. You've got a limited amount of time to go scout. You're looking for some evening bucks that are feeding. You're going to get to hunt, you know, you're scouting after work for a couple nights and you're going to hunt on Saturday. Are you going to go prioritize a standing bean field that's still hanging out there waiting for the combine, or a shelled cornfield? You can see because the corn's been shelled, but there's, you know, it drops some ears out there. Which one are you going to prioritize in that hour of daylight you've got to scout?
I will be at the shelled cornfield.
Okay. Number five, this has to do with rifle caliber. So highly opinionated folks, anytime it comes to what's your favorite rifle caliber, and they're going to tell you you're wrong. Somebody will. But I'm just curious. We've got the fast and flat 20 caliber. So 243, 25-06, Remington 260, 6mm. Do you prefer one of those or the more traditional, the 30 calibers, the 308? We got the new 305 Legend, the 30-06, 300 Weatherby Magnum. Where do you land in that camp?
Growing up, my first several deer I shot with my grandfather's old 30-30 Marlin.
Mm-hmm.
Took some nice bucks with it, but lately I've been shooting a 7mm odd-8 the last couple years. But
okay,
whatever. You know, I would say I almost prefer that 30-30. I think if I do still have a tag in rifle season, that's probably what I'm going to switch back to.
Nice. Okay.
Rob, you're telling me people have opinions about this?
Yeah, and they're all wrong, because if you ask anybody.
That's a whole nother podcast.
Yeah. Okay, so what's your favorite, question number six, what's your favorite off-season / summer activity? Chasing kids around at the ball field? I know you've got a 1-year-old, so you're not doing that yet. catching crappie, running bank lines on the river somewhere, playing golf. What are you doing in the off season?
Oh, I got the off season. I've got into bow fishing the last few years, and I'll try to spend as many nights as I can out on the lakes, taking care of the invasive species in our Kansas lakes.
Okay. That sounds like fun. Swatting mosquitoes, I'm sure.
Oh my goodness. It's never ending. But also we like to travel in the summertime. We go up to Omaha for the College World Series every year at least for a weekend for baseball games. And so I would say Omaha and the College World Series, and then coming back and shooting as many fish as I can.
Cool. Okay. Number seven. So, you know, you and I are maybe not quite neighbors, but we're pretty close. And so familiar with the Flint Hills, and the region. And so knowing what the topography is on most of where you guys are hunting at, I'm curious, what is your favorite, Flint Hills prairie land? So you were talking about those, you know, feeder creeks and draws, and maybe got some scattered timber, pursuing some deer, or are you more apt to go sit on like a bottomland plow ground next to a creek or a river where there's good, you know, covered dirt and there's timber and things like that?
Early season, you know, I think definitely it helps if you can be on the crop fields around the river bottom type of ground. But as soon as it gets to Halloween, I would like to find the deepest, nastiest canyon or draw in the Flint Hills and get in there about an hour and a half before sunrise and sit there till dark and just hopefully have the right doe come through leading a trail of bucks that can change your life around in a hurry.
Yeah, I understand. Cool. Okay. Last question, number eight. And again, we're back into that. There's no right answer, but they're all going to be wrong, right? Because there's so many opinions. Question number eight. So we're in the Flint Hills during the rut with a bow and some big old gnarly draw. It's cold out. And here comes a doe, and behind her is the buck of your dreams. Is that a whitetail buck that some big old gnarly, non-typical, he's got, you know, cactus points sticking out. He's got four brow tines on one side. Maybe he's got a drop tine, like he just looks like a mess. Or is it that solid, you know, 10 or 12 point buck with just crazy mass, crab claws out on the end, but they match, like just a stone typical, very few deductions, but they're going to score close to the same, you know, in inches. Which of those bucks is the one that you dream about at night?
I dream about the big clean typical, whether it be a 10 or a couple G5s to turn them into a 12 point. I would absolutely love to get one of those on my wall.
Cool. Yeah. Again, you know, no right answer, but you're going to be wrong.
Oh yeah.
I love that. That's a good question, because I imagine you get a lot of different responses on that one, Rob.
Sure. Yeah. You know, personally, I'm not going to be brokenhearted about either one. But if I had to pick, yeah, that stone typical. My wife killed a 14 point buck that was just nice. I don't know how much deduction it had, but very little. I mean, he just, brow tines were practically the same length, had the same mass on the main beam, just a beautiful deer.
Absolutely. Yeah, that would be the buck of my dreams also.
Yeah.
Not jealous at all, are you, Rob?
Not jealous at all, no.
I love that. Well, Shane, thank you so much for tuning in with us. I hope that lots of folks listen to this episode and share it with their friends, but also, you know, consider looking you up. So how can people find you if they're interested in booking or just learning more about CNS Whitetails?
So on social media, we've got a CNS Whitetails Facebook account set up. I've also got my personal accounts, which are mostly just business stuff on there now or stuff with our clients. Our website is severely outdated, so do not go to cnswhitetails.com. Look me up on Facebook, send me a message, and would love to talk to you guys.
Cool. This seems to be a common trend here, Rob. I don't know if you've caught on to this, but folks who are outfitters or bloggers or run guide services, they're like, don't look me up on my website, just go to my Instagram or Facebook, or just here's my phone, call me. Like,
yeah.
Well, it speaks to how much work y'all are putting in on the ground, right? Like, you don't have time to mess with the website. You guys are doing really good work, and I appreciate you, Shane, everything you've done for our program and continue to do for our kids and our community. Thank you.
Absolutely. It's come to be our favorite weekend of the year, and we are very, very much so looking forward to next week and having all those kids out.
Likewise. Well, thank you all for tuning in to the Great Plains Outdoors podcast, and we'll plan to catch you next time.
See you later, guys.
Thank you guys for having me.